This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about, you know you can retire, but can you afford to retire? And to lead us in that discussion is Dwayne Jackson. Dwayne is a principal with the firm Rembert, Pendleton & Jackson in Falls Church and Leesburg, Virginia. Good morning, Dwayne.
Morning, Bob.
And I should also say, certified financial planner, CPA, fellow seminar presenter as well. And next to him is Tammy Flanagan, senior benefit director, NITP, GovExec columnist, seminar presenter. What else do you do in your spare time?
Occasional co-host.
Occasional co-host.
All right. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. And I'm Bob Lines, and I'm co-host with Tammy most of the time. Anyway, Dwayne, can I retire? Now, we're probably not going to spend a ton of time with beginning career folks, but we have to bring them into the mix, especially with what you talked about when we were in the, quote, green room, end of quote. But let's take a look at pre-retirement. That's somewhat of a bread and butter, but mid-career is really when you should start to drill down. But again, this is your thing. I'm pre-retirement. I know I'm going to retire, but can I afford to? How do I know if I can afford to? I think I have a good pension, but do I have enough money?
Well, when I get that question, the answer is always, have you proved it to yourself on paper? You need to reconcile cash in and cash out. Very few people actually go through the process of looking at what their future expenses are going to be and do their assets and income streams match up with those expenses.
Now, to get real, we did a presentation at a convention a number of years ago called Get Real About Retirement Dollars. And what we did is we said, okay, let's look at where your money goes and then just figure out what that's going to be in 5 years, 10 years, whenever you're going to, ignoring inflation just for the moment. You get a total and then multiply it by inflation. But when people get real, what they bring home isn't necessarily, what they make isn't necessarily what they need to make in retirement, because you won't have things like Medicare. You won't have Medicare on retirement income.
Not the tax.
Unless you make an awful lot of money. You won't have Social Security if you're FERS. You won't have a contribution to the pension plan, be it FERS or CSRS. So there's some things that where we make X, we don't necessarily need to make X. That isn't necessarily the focal point. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I ask people, how much money do you need to hit your checking account on the first of the month so that the next 30 days are no big deal? And it really makes them think about what they're spending, accumulation of debt or pay down of debt. And then we take it on an after-tax basis, look at mortgage payments or any kind of systematic loans that they have to make sure that the real dollar amount that hits their account will sustain them for the next 30, 31 days.
Okay, that's a little bit with what we did. Again, same concept. We defined what we thought the expenses would be. I mean, all things considered, occasionally we're going to need a car. Occasionally we're going to need some major repairs to the home if we own it. Then Tammy's asked us to do a rent versus buy analysis. So it isn't necessarily that you always own it. But there are expenses that aren't your norm. Norm would be certainly food, rent, and or mortgage payment, whatever else, clothes.
I guess the bottom line is your expenses in retirement won't necessarily be less than what your expenses are when you're working, right? You're still going to have to pay your bills. You're still going to have to buy food. You're still going to have to pay insurance. So there's nothing magic that happens that, unless possibly like the kids actually grow up and leave the house and maybe the mortgage gets paid off at some point. And I think that used to be the old time plan for retirement is pay off the mortgage, get the kids out of the house, and then I can retire. Is there still something to be said for that?
Well, I have a lot of people who that is exactly their retirement plan. I have other clients who are going to subsidize their children and subsidize a mortgage company until the day they die. So every plan is unique.
It's different.
And that's the one you need to be careful when you hear seminar shows or read something to make sure that it applies to you and how you want this game to play out.
Right. Because I always have people ask me, because I'm always the day before the financial planner. And their first question is it true that you need 70 or 80% of your pre-retirement income to live on in retirement? And I say, wait till tomorrow, because I think there's more to it than just getting up to that percentage.
Exactly. You know, if you have no idea where to begin, that 70, 75% number is not bad. My client base, I've got some people who spend 110% in retirement because there's things they haven't seen, places they haven't gone, grandchildren that they haven't had a relationship with that, because they're states away. Mm-hmm. And I have other people that have retired to a, you know, two-bedroom farmhouse that's been paid off in, you know, Alabama. And, you know, to fish a little bit 3 days, 4 days a week is their entertainment. They need 40%, mm-hmm. 30% of what they were making.
So you just have to be realistic about what your plans are and what you think you're going to do once
Absolutely.
You retire.
Now, where is that in Alabama? It's not around here. Anyway, everybody doesn't stay around here.
No, not at all.
It's expensive, but everybody isn't in D.C. that's listening either. So we address first what our monthly fixed nut, if you will, would be. And then next is, where is it going to come from? And I guess you look at certainly the annuity, and that could be small or large depending on years in service, coverage, et cetera. And then Social Security, maybe. Is there going to be a second career? Although you ought to hold that as kind of a card to the side. If you have to, great. If you really want to, even better. But of course, you have to boil taxes out of that, because what you spend isn't what you make.
Exactly.
What you make is you're going to lose overall. Tax brackets vary, but you know, if you were just add all your taxes together divided by your income, it's probably 20%, and that's even with a state tax rate in there.
Sure.
But that's a whole lot lower than what tax brackets are. So when people say, no, I'm in the 25 plus the state, I'm in 30, and that's, you know, but it's like walking upstairs. You have to go up a number of stairs to get there.
Right. Yep.
You know, a lot of people always ask in the seminars if they have to pay tax on their Social Security benefit. And I'll say, well, there's a lot of people who don't pay any tax on their Social Security, but it won't be you.
Because, I do the same thing.
Because our federal audience, you know, they have an annuity, they have investment income. So because you have that other income, that makes at least a portion of your Social Security benefit also subject to tax.
You know, you realize that I think that calculation in taxes is the worst calculation on the return for most people. There's a three-step dance to it, but so many other things can affect it. The first step, you don't pay any taxes on it, but like you say, Tammy, most of the listening audience, again, whether you're mid-career or pre-retirement, you're not going to be there, so you're going to pay taxes on half of it. Mm-hmm. And if you're lucky, you pay taxes on 85% of it. You say, what do you mean? How can you be lucky by paying tax on 85%? That means you have more income. It's always better to have more income than less. But it's kind of like it floats a boat. I was working with a client the other day, and we were talking about taking money out of effectively a thrift, and they wanted to take a chunk out. But that put them into a situation where they went from zero taxable to 50% taxable on Social Security just by taking that money out. So you do have to be careful. And the first people listening to that, that's fairly important, because they are going to get Social Security. And if they're kind of wavering between going to the 50 to the 85% bracket, watch out how much they take out of the thrift if they're taking monthly distributions mm-hmm. that they have control over. Or transfer some over to an IRA and take out every other year. And that sounds a little idealistic, because one needs money to eat. You can't eat every other year.
I think that goes back to what Dwayne was saying, is see what your outgoing expenses are and then see what your normal income is going to be between perhaps Social Security and your basic government retirement benefit if you're a federal retiree, and then see what difference you need. Like if you're still short $600 a month and you know you're going to have to deduct that from your investment income, and how long will that last? We're right. $6,000 a month short. You're even in worse shape.
It started at the beginning, and before the show, Dwayne was talking about a young man that was in his class, a pre-retirement class, and he said most of the people were of pre-retirement age, and this person was in their 20s, and Dwayne, and I do the same thing. Maybe you do it, Tammy. Say, why are you here? In a nice way.
And I congratulate them for being there. I'm like, yeah. You're the smartest one in the room.
Yeah. And basically, I think that's what this person said.
Yeah. Well, he kind of fought his way in there, because the person said, you know, we really want people within 5 or 10 years of retirement. And his point was, nobody can use this information better than mm-hmm. than me at this point. So very, very commendable for him to kind of take the bull by the horn, so to speak, and plan his own life out.
Okay, if we move forward then, let's take a look at a mid-career person. It's somewhat hard for them to project what their retirement income is, but they have to develop certain investing habits early on because it's 60, 65, 58. It's, I won't say too late, but it's getting there. So when you sit down with somebody in a mid-career age group, what do you drill down to first?
The first thing is, do you have a written plan? And have you defined what financial success is for you and your family? That is so important to have that done, solidify the goals, and then your activity will follow.
What do you mean by that, though? Like, how would you start making a – I wouldn't even know where to start, like have a goal for the future.
What I ask them is, you know, what is it that's important to you, your family, the
like,
people
in other words,
you love?
Like, do I want to retire at a young age, or am I willing to work till I'm 70?
Retirement age, mm-hmm. The ability to have a mortgage paid off, mm-hmm. The ability to have college funding set at a certain level. Do you need help with parents?
Yeah. You know, so there's going to be any financial goal that's part of your family.
Right. Absolutely.
All right. And then, how do they monitor that, or how do they not get caught in the trap of buying a bigger home, buying a car they shouldn't buy? If not everybody has children, but we have to watch out and save for that through, what do they call those things, 529s.
Well, it's been very, very difficult the last decade as the accumulation of items became more important in our society. And if there's a good thing that has come out of the financial debacle of 08 and the beginning of 09 is people are going back to basics and really understanding what's important to them, what their basic needs are. Those kind of got lost in the shuffle because everybody was accumulating the want mm-hmm. items, the bigger cars, the bigger houses, and all of a sudden we've fallen on rough times, and some of these people are having trouble meeting their basic needs because they never spent time, you know, confronting that issue.
Yeah. It's 10:17, Monday, June 7th, this a.m., and it's Eastern time. We are live. We'll be live for another half hour or so, 40 minutes. Please call us, 877-936-9333, 877-936-9333. If you're listening to us after 10:58 Eastern time a.m., on Monday, June 7th, don't call that number because we won't be here, but you can certainly email us. You can email us at foryourbenefit@nitpinc.com. foryourbenefit@nitpinc.com. Anyway, and we're not farming emails. We're just here to answer your questions and as best we can. So, next issue, and you touched on it, and we talked about it before we came in here. What good came out of the bad in 2008 and 9?
Well, again, I think it's people getting back to basics, becoming more focused on what's important to them on a needs basis. Minimizing debt has been a good thing that's come out of it. People are looking to try to pay off debt, and they're saving more. So savings rates are up.
Now, when you meet the savers, everybody hates to see the value of their investment go down if you invest in the stock market. But what do you tell people? How do you talk them off the ledge after this past Friday or a year and a half ago?
Or 2008.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we've been doing a lot of ledge talking here in the last couple of years. So the biggest thing is having a diversified portfolio so that you don't have all your eggs in one basket. And that's very cliche. People forgot about that. But it's been hammered home the last 36 months or so. Second is to make sure that you have adequate cash reserves. You know, you should not be investing all of your money in equities. Short-term, high-quality bonds, cash, even though we're not getting much of a rate of return on it, it's not going down by 3% at a certain time. So if you need money for home repairs, auto repairs, sending a child to college, as long as you're able to withdraw that money from a cash source, you're able to give your portfolio time to recover.
Do you talk to people in their portfolio to have metals in it, gold, commodities?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yep. Basically, we like to have our clients in 12 to 14 very distinct asset classes. And I love the TSP. I love all the options of the TSP. I just wish there were about two or three times as many. When you look back over the last 10 years, the best rates of return were found in asset classes that are not available in the thrift savings plan. So one of the things that we talk about in the seminars is taking your IRA money, your Roth money, your brokerage money, and investing in investments that are not found within the TSP. Don't buy an S&P index fund in your Roth IRA. You already have that in the TSP.
In that same light, if you're a FERS employee who's getting matching contributions on your thrift, but you only get those matching up to 5%, would you tell someone to take additional money rather than max out their TSP account, take their other savings money that's available for future retirement savings and do it outside of the thrift? Or would you still have them take advantage of the tax savings of diversifying or diverting money from taxes? That's always a question that I get coming up, and I wondered how you answer that.
It comes up in almost every seminar, and the answer I say, and I begin by taking a magic marker and I draw about a 3-foot asterisk, and I say, this answer that I'm getting ready to give you comes with a huge asterisk. I can make a very good point to take your 5%, get the matching from your employer, and then take the next $5,000 or $6,000 and invest it in a Roth IRA. The caveat and the asterisk comes with, are you actually going to do it? It just seems people always wait to the last minute to fund their Roth, and that April 14th, when you need to spend or invest that $5,000 the next day, is when the furnace goes out. It's when the refrigerator busts or the car needs tires or something.
So the money doesn't end up in your IRA.
So the money a lot of times doesn't end up there. I mean, the greatest thing about the thrift savings plan is it just accumulates over time. You know, it takes a couple conscious acts to get it set up, and then it just keeps working from that point forward.
But I think a lot of people should realize you can do that with an IRA. You can do an automatic allotment out of a checking account or a savings account so that you do that investing first before you figure out what else you need to spend money on.
Right, right. You can. It still has a little bit of an optional edge to it, and some people can't control themselves not to cancel that option when they have cash needs that are coming up.
Right.
Does that also help them with something called dollar cost averaging, mm-hmm. what Tammy was talking about, which I like that. It mm-hmm. comes out of the check, and initially it hurts, and you look at it and say, why am I doing it? But after a while, it's automatic.
It's going in no matter what. Whatever the market's doing, you're still investing.
You're investing every month, every week. How does dollar cost averaging work? You know, people say that, and my eyes used to glaze. And you can dollar cost average down to the basement, or you can dollar cost average up to the the sky.
Well, dollar cost averaging forces what our normal behavior should be, which is to minimize our purchasing when things get more expensive. So when the C fund is going up and up, or the S fund is going up and up in value, you're actually buying fewer units with that $100 a month, $500 a month, or whatever. However, when it starts to get less expensive, or starts to, what I say, go on sale, kind of do the analogy with a retail purchase, those dollars that you're investing buy more units. So, yes, what you have is going down in value. What's already on the shelf is going down in value, but you're purchasing more accumulation units for the future. When the market comes back, you have a trampoline effect because you have so much more in inventory that can rise with the markets.
Okay, and people that shy away from the markets, or they get out as it tumbles, or they get out at the basement, and they don't get back in as it starts to rise.
Yeah, and I wanted to make a point about that, because here's Dwayne. This is what he does for a living, is financial planning. I'll bet you any money, if I ask him this next question, his answer is going to be no. You don't take all of your clients' money and move it to a safe haven and then move it all back in the market when you think it's going to go up, right? You don't perform that behavior.
No. I mean, we're not market timers.
Right.
Our firm has a process called asset allocation. We try to, again, get you spread out amongst 10, 12, 14 sometimes investments that are exposed to the world economies, bonds, stocks, real estate, et cetera. And do not time the market.
But what do you have to say to that behavior? Because I meet them people every single day. They say, oh, man, I got out just in time. I moved everything to G Fund, and I'm sitting there, and I need to know now when to put it back in. It's like,
I grabbed one of my colored charts in anticipation of the radio show, and for the last 20 years, real estate has earned about 10% a year. The S&P 500 has been up over 8%, bonds 7%, oil 5%. All these investments have done fairly well average annualized over the last 20 years, the average investor has come out at 2.3%, which is the worst performer. So you have people out there who are investing in the markets, and consistently, no matter what time period you look at, no matter what company does the study, the individual investor underperforms the investments that they're participating in. And it just it screams the behavior of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it just it's the timing that they don't get right. So you just need to monitor your allocation. I hate buy and hold, because a lot of people it becomes buy and forget, mm-hmm. buy and ignore, which is completely wrong. But you need to buy and monitor. You need to buy and tweak and be responsible and prudent for your investment outcome.
Do they also call that rebalancing?
Well, rebalancing would typically, at the end of a year, maybe 15, 18 months, you don't want to do it too often. Our original allocation, if you wanted to do something simple like 60% stocks and 40% bonds, at the end of a year, you might have 70 or 75% stocks and 30 or 25% bonds. So the rebalance would be to get me back to my original allocation, which means I'm selling stocks and buying bonds. And it's almost like dollar cost averaging in reversed. It's forcing us to sell what's doing really well and buy what's underperformed. So the behavior that rebalancing emphasizes and supports is buying low and selling high. And if you constantly buy low and sell high, you can make money investing over time.
Great. Now, we're moving quickly through some of this terminology. And those of you all listening live can also listen to this archived. It goes up on the net, what, about 2 or 3 o'clock this afternoon, Dorothy? Dorothy says yes. And it stays there for a long period of time, so you can listen. And what's nice about listening on the web as well, you can control and stop it. It's got one of those little thermometer things at the bottom. You can go back and whatnot. But all that is great, but how would somebody get in touch with you, Duane?
If they want, they can certainly give us a call at 703-821-6655. Email is daj@rpjadvisors.com.
Okay, one more time.
daj@rpjadvisors.com.
Okay, great. And the phone number?
703-821-6655.
Thank you. All right, I'll have to call that number. All righty, so we talked about the mid-career folks and... What about the pre-retirement? I mean, the pre-retirement folks we get, what would you say? They're anywhere from late 50s to middle 60s. Is that the sweet spot, would you say, that our pre-retirement seminars?
Yeah, most of them.
Most often.
In that area.
Yeah. And what do they do? Especially on the latter side of that, the middle 60s or the early 60s, it's kind of hard to change. It's kind of hard to save a bunch. Do they have to look at paring down their expenses? Do they have to look at working longer? And Tammy, I might ask you that. Let's take a first person. For every year that they put off retirement, ignoring that they're going to make more on the job than in retirement, how does that affect their annuity?
Well, that's the beauty of working for the government, because if you look at things and you do the exercises Duane's talking about and you come out short, you say, wow, you know, I thought I had enough, but I don't. What do I do now? Well, you can keep working. And for every month that you work, your salary is going up on the average of your high three, which is the basis of your FERS or CSRS retirement, plus your length of service is going up. And both of those factors will create more money in your basic government pension. And on top of that, you're still contributing taxes to Social Security, and those wages are going to count towards your future benefit. So every day that you work, you're increasing these set benefits, plus hopefully adding to your investment income as well, so you're saving more money for the future. And the part we don't like to think about is you're decreasing the amount of time that you'll need it for, because the longer you work, the less time you'll be actually spending it in retirement as well. So there's got to come a point in time, because you could work forever and keep increasing your benefits, but you never get to enjoy it. So the problem is trying to find out where's the time when you feel like, I can afford this, I have a plan for the future, now let's set the date. You know, because setting the date's the last step of the process. It's the financial and the mental preparation. It can take some time.
that we do cover in the seminars.
We do.
Now, let's come back over the other side of that now, Dwayne. What do you do with somebody that is short, if you will?
Can I read my email? Because this is a perfect example.
Of course you can.
And it sounds like when somebody listens to this email, they're going to think, who in the world? But you would be surprised at every seminar I meet people like this. And it's kind of sad, but I think there are some solutions. So maybe we could talk about them. I had an email Friday for the show today, and she said she retired from federal service April 30th of this year. Her FERS retirement, she must not have a lot of service because her retirement's only going to be $300 a month from her FERS basic benefit. And she only has $28,000 in her TSP account. Needless to say, I have very little to work with. My question is, what is the best way to go with the TSP? I would need as much money as I could get monthly for as long as possible. I'm 62 years old. I could live to 100 or die tomorrow. I'm divorced and I'm single, so it's just me. Seems like all the examples I read deal with large sums of money for the FERS and TSP. Nothing on the best way to go for us poor ones. Any help would be greatly appreciated. And my first inclination was to say, don't retire, keep working, but that's already been done. She's retired. And she's probably going to have to draw Social Security as well unless she decides to go back to work. So is there any advice we can give her?
Well, again, you have to reconcile cash in with cash out, and it's going to be very tough for this person to do that. The first thing that kind of shocked me about this was it seems like she retired, and now she's analyzing what her situation is. It's a little bit in reverse.
Right.
You definitely want to know where your expenses are, where your income is coming from, and then decide whether or not you should retire.
Right. She didn't mention a health issue, but assuming that there are no health issues, I think continuing to work a little longer, because at 62, your Social Security benefit for someone who's 62 this year is reduced by 25%. So just working another 4 years could not only increase the monthly benefit, but also avoid that penalty for early retirement. Which I think is a good option for someone who is supporting themselves and going to try to live on this income. Because $28,000 is really not going to last if she lives to be 100.
No, I mean, you're looking at taking out 4 to 5% of that number per year. So you're looking at $100, $110 a month, which it's going to help, but it's not going to go very far. So it's kind of one of those. She was probably in a position where she could retire based upon age, but really shouldn't have at that point.
I think this is something, too. I wrote a column not long ago for women and retirement planning, because I think when somebody has something happen mid-career, such as a divorce, like this person may not have worked outside the home, may have been raising the kids, doesn't have income of their own, so here they are kind of at a later time in their life trying to start over and make things work. So I think doing that financial planning ahead of time is a must, and you got to have a reality check. Sometimes you can't retire as young as you might have hoped to. Is it just not possible?
I personally learned that. I was going to retire at 50. And then that happened. I go, 55, and then 60, and then it's 62, 65, 70. I don't know.
I think yours is the mental preparation,
yeah,
too. You like working.
Yeah, I do.
you enjoy what you do.
It's my hobby. Anyway, fortunately, there are not many like me.
But I think that early career is really where we need to start, whether we're female, getting married, going to raise a family, whether we're just graduating college, starting that full career. I think if you can get to somebody at that point in their life, then they can make those long-term goals and start doing things now so they're not facing this situation when they turn 62.
Absolutely.
So how does somebody become financially literate that isn't, and they do have some time, unlike the emailer, maybe they have 5 years yet to go, 7 years yet to go. And of course, listening to the show every week would be great, but everybody can't or won't do that. Are there courses to take? Or are there any good books to read?
The information is out there. Lord knows with the big bookstores, with the internet, all the information you need to become financially literate and savvy is there for the taking. The question I ask my audiences before we even really get going is, how many of you all really love today's topic? We're going to go over financial planning, tax planning, investment planning. How many of you all love today's topics? And in an audience of 40 people, I'll get two or three who raise their hand. Yep. And then I'll follow that up with, okay, love it or not, how many of you all are really good at it? And even those two or three people usually then put their hands down. It's a tough topic. If you don't really love this stuff, I think it's going to be very difficult for you to become financially savvy because you're not going to read the books and you're not going to do the worksheets. So then, you know, it's an opportunity to find somebody that can guide you through the process, perhaps.
Now, I'm not a financial planner, but people come into the office, and you probably snicker when I say this because your programs are probably a whole lot more colorful and more zeroing in on the subject. But I go to this ballpark estimate. It's called savings.com, and it's got all these calculators, and one's called the interactive bulb. It's just very simple, and you say, okay, how old are you? And it just quickly says, you need to save $15,000 a month. And you go, I don't make $15,000 a month. So then it's kind of a quick
reality
slap of reality. And then after that, say, what do I do? And I go see Dwayne.
I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Because he's got all the calculators and great ideas. And you sit down. How often do you sit down with your clients?
We typically meet on a quarterly basis. Some clients I have to drag kicking and screaming into the office once every couple years. But we review investment portfolio and decisions that affect their financial planning, typically on a quarterly basis, certainly a couple times a year.
All righty. Now, how well did the meetings go in 2008?
They were lengthy, and they were a lot more emotional than the meetings that we had 2002 through 2007. But I think what got our clients through this whole process is the fact that we were meeting and that we were talking about it.
And they weren't on their own. They weren't floundering trying to figure, what do I do?
Right.
And some security knowing you were kind of watching that for them.
Right. And you look back at September of 2008 and you say, okay, your portfolio is down for the year at about where your sticking point is. Do you want to make it more conservative? Do we need to raise cash? And just gives them a process of control that helped them greatly come through this, as I call it, the debacle.
Okay, and we made the comment, you know, what good came out of that? Probably the bad was the good. Well, you know, I can't live like I'm living, and I reasonably cut back. We can't not eat,
right?
But maybe we don't need the cars and the clothes and the vacations, and we're kind of stuck with the house.
I've heard the phrase "cash is king" a lot more in the last couple of years than I have the prior 20. So, you know, having that security blanket there, having some part of your portfolio that you know is not going to go down, i.e., the G Fund. I love the G Fund. I think it's a great investment choice within the TSP. Is a investment that you just have to have. And the last couple, 3 years drove those kind of risk management investments home.
And, oh, gentle listeners, just listen to what he just said. He said it before and said it a different way now. Inside the TSP, you have different investments. So why invest the same outside of the TSP? So in diversifying, don't look to mirror what's in there. And one of the things that's in there is the G Fund. Well, there's nothing like it on the outside world.
Right.
There's no money market fund that pays that kind of rate where you have to, access to the money at your demand.
Right. One of the things that come up, because I kind of touch on the TSP before I let my classes go and come in to see Dwayne the next day for financial planning, but I'll say to them, you know, a lot of people will take a portion of their TSP account and transfer it to an IRA so they can do the things Dwayne's saying is diversify and do other things with their money. But I'll ask the class, I'll say, why do you think they leave some of the money in the thrift? And they all look at me blankly. I don't know. You know, why don't they just move it all to the IRA? And I'll say, there's two things kind of unique about the thrift that you won't find anywhere else. And one of them is the G Fund. And then the other thing would be the low administrative expenses. And I guess there's something to be said for that, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. If you can invest successfully at the lowest expense possible, why wouldn't you do that?
Yeah.
So, but there's two big advantages and two big disadvantages to transferring your TSP money into an IRA. And what's confounding is they're both the same thing. You have unlimited investment options outside of the TSP. Some people, that's going to be a benefit. For a lot of people, that's not. That's the worst thing that could happen. They're confused and a little uneasy about what they should do with five options and tell them, congratulations, you now have 15,505 doesn't make that process any easier. Second is you've got absolute control of the money once it's in an IRA, and I think that's a tremendous advantage unless you can't handle it. Mm-hmm. So you have to be a little introspective and say, you know, for the first time in my life, I'm going to have control over a very large sum of money, and can I handle it, or should I leave it in a very structured environment that has structured distribution processes?
Mm-hmm. One of those distribution processes within the TSP, I'm not so sure a lot of people are aware of. I call it choice three. Choice one is to move it into an IRA. Choice two is to take it out all at once, which would only appeal to somebody in their early 70s. Buy an annuity in today's market. And the third one is to take monthly payments. But there's two subsets of that. One is you're locked in. It's like a ticket on a train and it's got one stop. So you're on a monthly payment to be spread out over your lifetime. But the second one I really think is better. It's you take the monthly payments based on what you want. Not monthly, but you can change that figure, I believe, Tammy, annually?
Currently, once a year. They've talked about, and I'm not sure if it's available yet, but they want to make it more often. But right now, it's once a year you can adjust that payment. And you can also take the first option, the life expectancy payment, and switch it back to the self-directed payment once. You mm-hmm. can go backwards one time. So you can start off with a life expectancy. Maybe you hit that 70 and a half where you have a required distribution. And if you want to go back to taking your own directed distribution, you can do that as long as you're taking at least the monthly payment that's required.
And if you feel that you don't want it anymore, you can always stop and move the rest to an IRA, if I'm not mistaken.
You can.
When do they have to make that annual election if they're controlling the amount? Is it December?
December. They get the survey for next year. Like, what do you want starting in January?
Okay, so those listening to that, you could keep your payment low if you didn't need it, and then let's say you needed a car and you wanted to pay it off 3, 4, or 5 years, you can jack the monthly payment up. Or if you wanted to buy a house, and people say, I want to take $100,000 or $50,000 out of my thrift and put it down on the house. And I go, no, you don't, because you're going to lose 30% of it to taxes or 25% of it to taxes or whatever bracket they might be in. So you really don't get what you think you want. Take monthly payments. Take monthly payments, you pay the taxes on the monthly payments, and they go, well, my mortgage would increase. Well, one somewhat offsets the other, not exactly. So the mortgage interest may or may not be fully equal as far as tax deductible to what's coming out of the thrift, which was 100% taxable. Anyway, I'm getting out there with that example.
Yeah, well, another thing on the comparing the different payout options, because you have the annuity, which you kind of said, you know, oh, in this market, who wants it? But a lot of people will ask, like, what's the difference between the annuity option versus the series of payments where you tell them to pay it over your life expectancy? And I'll tell them, you know, very simply, the biggest difference is when you receive that first annuity payment, you have nothing left in your thrift. Where when you receive that first monthly distribution based on your life expectancy, you have everything still in your thrift except for the first monthly payment. And there's a big difference there that you still have control over your money versus you've given it all to an insurance company to pay out over your lifetime.
That's right. And if you're assured that you're a descendant of Methuselah, then the annuity might not be bad. But when interest rates rise, buying it today, well, what am I? I'm talking to the person that knows this stuff. But
do you have clients who buy annuities? Is there a person who it's suited for?
Every now and again, someone who's very conservative, does not want to leave that lump sum to somebody. Mm-hmm. Perhaps they're single, or everybody in their family is already independently wealthy. They might choose to say, I will take that guaranteed check at the first of the month and go with it. My only caution to them is, you know, that $500 a month or $1,000 a month when you're 65 is not going to be the same $1,000 a month on a purchasing power if you hit 75 or 85.
Mm-hmm. Unless you get some kind of inflation adjustment, then you don't get much to begin with.
They're going to adjust that by reducing your annuity payment is. So.
Okay, kind of like the base annuity with the Fed.
Yeah.
Right.
You want a survivor's annuity, you get less while you're alive.
Right.
And
right.
The same thing is true, I guess, with the annuity option within the TSP.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. I think the interest rate index they're paying on the TSP annuity right now is, I think, 3.75%. And 2 or 3 years ago, it was as high as almost 6%. And when you lock in that rate, it's locked in for the life of the annuity, which is, I think, why you were saying in this economy, not a good choice because it's such a low interest rate. that's for life. You know, you're stuck with it.
I tell this tired old story at every seminar, and it's a true story. Although it was about 11 years ago, and this will show you why I am not a financial planner. And a friend called up and said, I'm leaving the feds, and the person is very good managing their money. And so I said, what are you going to do, put the TSP in an IRA and play with it? And the response was, no, I'm going to buy the MetLife annuity. And I said, why would you do that? It only pays about 7.3% interest. The person had good genes and still is fortunately with us today and enjoying that great decision that I tried to second guess.
So, talk him out of.
I think at that point I said, I don't think I was born to be a financial planner. I'll just count beans and do tax returns.
There you go.
All right. Talking about tax returns, one of our listeners, and seems we're getting more and more, emailed in and said, when you do the show Monday, and Tammy was good enough to say, did you send this yesterday or Saturday?
I started going back and forth with the person, and I thought, I'll send it to Bob for the show on Monday.
Okay.
Because it kind of fit our topic.
All righty. So the question was, should I rent or buy? And there's a I went to a website.
And I'm not sure if this means he already... What does he do now? Like, he lives someplace. So does it mean he's already owning something, wants to sell it and rent? Or I'm not sure where that came from.
Or they're moving and they say, okay, do I rent a place?
Oh, okay.
Forget the taxes.
Like, put all my money from the house somewhere and then just rent for the next.
I think if you're moving, you ought to rent anyway, just to see that you're living in the right area of the city. But that's Michael Creedon's psychological stuff and not mine. I'm not saying that he's wrong. He's 100% right. But the monthly payment, I just threw these numbers in, and you can Google this. It says rent versus buy calculators, and a bunch of them come up. But this one seems to be the easiest to work with and the best, and it's called Time Value. Just one word, timevalue.com. And it says, okay, how much are you going to pay for rent? So I said, okay, $1,250. How much are you going to pay for renter's insurance? How much will the rent go up each year? And so you put the numbers in. And then you say, okay, if you buy, how much would you pay for your house? And I put $150,000 down. And then what's the down payment? Now, again, this gets into psychology of whether you want a mortgage or not. But I'm kind of pro-mortgage. So I said, okay, we're going to put 20% down. And what's the interest rate? I put 4.25%. Interest loan term, 30 years, points, 1%, closing costs, etc. And then how much were the property taxes? So I'm not trying to drive you all crazy with this, but then the question was, what's your state and federal tax rate? I put 25%. Now, again, that's state and federal, and that might be a little high. And interest rate that they're going to earn, I made it low, 2.3%. How long will you stay in the home? 10 years. And it basically said that if you stay in the home for an extended period of time, 10 years, you'd be $78,000 ahead. But then what they did...
If
you buy. Mm-hmm. But what was nice about this analysis, they put it on a graph. And it showed that in the first 5 years, it wasn't a good move.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until after the fifth year that it started to be better to own than to rent. But in the early stages, it was much better to rent because of the money you'd have to put in up front, the settlement costs and the like. And the other thing about tax rates, you know, are rumored just to go through the roof, but I think they're going through the roof for those that have extremely high income. I went and Googled something. Tax rates based on the 2011 budget, because I couldn't find any proposal. I'd seen what they were supposedly to be, but I was shocked to see how it didn't do much for most people. It really whacked them at the high end, but I think we all know that. But it didn't hurt the middle income types or the middle income plus types. But point being, again, is, you know, do you get a mortgage just to get a tax deduction? I hope not. Now, you get a mortgage to give what you otherwise would have put down on the house to Dwayne. Mm-hmm. And then he can do better than the mortgage rate. And, you know, in today's environment with mortgage rates, and I use 4.25%, I think I saw some below 4, but they were ARMs. They were like 3-year ARMs or 5-year ARMs. For those of you, ARM it's an adjusted rate. So it stays low. It's kind of like a teaser for a while, and then it jumps up with whatever the market rate is at the time. Is that the way it works with ARMs?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
But is there something to be said for home equity and owning your home when it comes to things like long-term care down the road, or if you ever had to file for bankruptcy? Would there be some benefit to owning your home rather than paying rent?
Well, I mean, you have a source of equity, you have a source of resources that you can get to if you do a reverse mortgage or just selling it at that mm-hmm. point. You now have a certain amount of equity there that you can then spend on your long-term care.
Yeah. So I guess it just depends on each person's situation, but I guess this calculator is a good way to start comparing that.
Yeah, you could fool with it. You could put more money down. Mm-hmm. There's a psychological kind of pushback. Mm-hmm. I don't want that high mortgage. And when I've worked with clients that I think are pretty good managing their money, I'd say, listen, why don't you do this? Why don't you have an automatic monthly withdrawal, go into your checking account from the thrift, have the monthly mortgage payment taken out of your account. Don't write the check because it's a monthly nightmare. And if the two meet and you put less money down on the house and you have more money in the thrift, for example, you might find it to your liking. And again, these people were not bad managing their money, or they used the services of somebody like you that made them the money.
Right, right.
Now, I'm not guaranteeing Dwayne's going to make you independently wealthy in 2 years. It'll take four with him.
Dwayne, if you were not in this area where I couldn't call you to be my financial planner, but how would you give someone advice on how to find someone who you can trust? Because I know there's a lot of worry about handing my decisions of my future over to a stranger that, they could just as easily sell me some products that makes them rich and doesn't do anything for me. So how do I know that I'm hiring someone who's really going to be looking after my best interests?
Well, I typically answer that question to say, what's the process that you go through to find a good doctor? What's the process that you go through to find a good auto repair person? And find somebody that you respect that is financially savvy, that has an advisor, and get two or three referrals. Mm-hmm. If you can't get a direct referral to somebody, you might want to go to the Certified Financial Planning CFP website, and they have a little drop down box as to how to find a CFP in your area and the questions that you should ask a planner.
And is there a difference between a financial planner versus a stockbroker?
The difficult thing about my industry is the verbiage and the mm-hmm. licensing is not standardized. Anybody really can hang out a shingle and call themselves a financial planner.
Right.
A stockbroker is somebody who principally derives their income from the sale or management of a stock portfolio for a client.
Mm-hmm.
The designation in the industry is certified financial planner, but at that point, somebody who sells insurance or sells stocks or does fee-only financial planning the way we do, can be a certified financial planner.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it very tough, though, the CFP exam?
It was tough for me. I don't know
I think
it's tough for everybody, but it was a lot shorter than the CPA exam. I'll give you that one. But I'm glad I've got both of them out of the way and don't have to do that anymore.
I've heard another designation called registered investment advisor. Is that some other designation you want to look for, or does that matter?
Typically, a registered investment advisor is someone who charges a fee for service. So they're more licensed through the federal government than the states.
So would that be something you want to look for, or wouldn't it make a whole lot of difference?
We think it's something that you should look for and consider.
Okay, Dwayne, help me with this. Fee for service versus managing money. What's the difference?
Well, our firm, we're fee-only financial advisor. So the only source of fee that our firm receives is the direct fees that our clients pay. Somebody who does sometimes do fee for service, they might also get a commission off of what they've the products that they've put somebody into. But you can do hourly engagements, charge somebody by the hour. We charge a percentage of the assets that we're managing for our clients.
Which is common in the industry, right?
Very common.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
Yep.
Plus, the more money your clients make, the more money you make, so you're both going to win. So if
you do
well for your clients, then everybody's happy.
Right. What I tell my clients is that if your account balances goes up, my fee goes up. If your account balances go down, my fee doesn't go away, but it does go down.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay, Dwayne, if I were a financial planner, which I, of course, will never be, what questions would you ask me? I know you're going to interview me. I can't answer your questions, but what would be good questions for our listening audience to ask a
potential financial advisor?
Certainly one is how long you've been in the area. I mean, how long you've been in the profession. How long have you been with the current firm that you're with? There's a lot of moving back and forth, jumping to different companies. So I think stability with a firm is very, very important. What designations do you have? And that speaks to continuing education on an annual basis. One question I ask is if I make an inquiry to the state business bureau, am I going to find anything that's going to be alarming in your past? And that's a very real issue.
Well, that's a good
today.
Thing to ask, because it gives them a chance to say why, if
right.
there is.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of it is how do you charge for your services? Do you are you commission based? Are you fee only based? Exactly how do you derive your compensation? And then very important is describe your typical client. And if you're a federal employee and this person has 98% of their clients as veterinarians, that might not be a good fit.
Good match. And there are a lot of people who do have a lot of federal clients, which might be something to look at, because then they'd be more familiar with your other benefits like your annuity and your Social Security coverage and so forth.
A couple of things that I guess I get questions when people come in. They say, do you explain the black and white and gray of taxation? And I guess the same thing would hold true. Can you show me what aggressive versus cautious versus middle of the road would be? And do you speak English? In other words, do you speak your jargon or do you speak English? And I find most people really want the English because mm-hmm. they don't understand the jargon.
Right.
Especially in the world I live in, and I'm certain the world that you live in, I know the world Tammy lives in. Tammy's articles, I just love them because I can understand them.
Yeah, because I always worry about somebody who goes to their benefits office and gets the response that, well, I would explain it to you, but it's too complicated. To me, that means the person doesn't understand it, or they could explain it to you in a simpler way. So if you have somebody who can talk to you in your language, that makes all the difference in the world, because, you know, if you understand what they're telling you, then you can make use of that information.
All righty, as we wind this down, final comments? Dwayne?
My big comment is this material, being financially successful, is fairly simple, but it's not always easy.
That's right.
And you do have to do some hard work to get from A to Z.
All righty, Tammy?
Well, we didn't talk about the life cycle funds, but I guess that wouldn't be a bad place to start, rather than just throw everything in one fund and hope for the best, or
right.
split it up over 10 options and hope for the best.
Right. I like the lifestyle funds. Mm-hmm. I would prefer somebody to target their buying and selling a little bit more actively, but versus doing nothing or just splitting it 50-50 between two options, the lifestyle funds are a very good choice.
All right. Thanks. And next week we're on with Mike Causey and John Elliott, and the topic is around the horn, benefit-wise, legislative-wise, and money-wise. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. D. Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics.
Are you on Facebook? Do you Twitter? So does Federal News Radio. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FedNewsRadio or join the Federal News Radio Facebook group.